You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Good evening. Welcome, everyone. My name is Sean Dove, and I am the manager of the Open Society Foundation's Campaign for Black Male Achievement. And I want to welcome you to yet another inspiring, informative gathering that the campaign is hosting. It was launched almost 3 years ago here at the foundation to improve the life outcomes of black men and boys. We are doing some really interesting and inspiring investments in the areas of education, work, and family. And at the top of our list is really just keeping the issue, the crisis and the opportunities facing black men and boys at the center of the national, public, philanthropic, and political discourse. And so any opportunity we get, we throw, I would say a party, but sometimes it is like a party in here or a gathering to just really address the issues, to network, and just to build our community capacity to really respond effectively to the issues that we're dealing with in this community. So we typically like to launch our events with some arts and culture. You know, you might get some spoken word in here. Last month, when we closed the month for National Mentoring Month, we had a colleague kick us off with a solo on his saxophone. He's an administrative coordinator by day, but a saxophonist by night, and so we had him come in and share his talent. And today I'm just really thrilled to kick this evening off with the National Black Anthem. And I want to introduce Maya Cunningham, who is a jazz singer. She hails from our nation's capital, graduate of Howard University. We have some Howard folks. I know last month we had a bunch of Howard folks in the house that were kind of rowdy and raucous, and every time you mention Howard, so I have some Wesleyan colleagues here. Wesleyan's in the house? Yes, okay, good. All right, so we're not gonna go there, but Maya is certainly a game changer, and I was talking to her, and she said that she had the honor and opportunity to sing the anthem for Winnie Mandela at Columbia University back in 2003. And so I want you to know, Maya, that we're happy to have you here. You are amongst royalty still, again. And so let's welcome Maya so she can just help us to open this evening in the right way.
Good evening. Lift every voice and sing till earth and heaven ring, ring with the harmonies of liberty. Let our rejoicing rise. Let it resound loud as a rolling sea. Sing a song full of the faith that the dark past has taught us. Sing a song full of the faith that the present has brought us. Facing the rising sun of our new day begun, let us march on till victory. Let us march on till victory. Let us march on till victory is won.
Thank you.
Come on, we can do much better than that for Maya. We got those Howard folks in the house. Let's hear it. Wow, thank you. Marching on to victory is won. We are at the campaign, and they're kind of hiding behind the pole there, but I'm going to ask them to step out. The campaign team, Rashid Shabazz and Haley Roberts, the program officer, and come on, step out. Because we are, and we truly believe we are doing mighty work, and we really believe in this mission to improve the life outcomes for black men and boys, that it's moving mountains. And this is work that requires collaboration, requires teamwork, and we have a great, great team. And for those of you that know Haley, nothing gets done without Haley and coordinating this. So I just really want to lift up my colleagues and the great work that they do. And, you know, this is really about partnerships. And so tonight is an opportunity. We are going to obviously hear from Dr. Randall Pinkett, and who is a game changer, and really looking forward to hearing from him. But it is also a night where we have an opportunity to campaign to lift up our partners and our grantee partners. And so there are a number of folks that are on the panel tonight that are influencers. They may not have books out yet, but they are influencers just the same as Dr. Pinkett. And I want to introduce Nicole Sharp, who is going to be our moderator for the evening. And she's also going to introduce Dr. Pinkett. And Nicole is the director of the Black Male Donor Collaborative, which is administered by the Schott Foundation. I've had the pleasure of working with her for the last over a year in that capacity. Open Society is one of the core funders for this initiative, one of the founding funders. And the collaborative is a unique partnership between philanthropic and corporate sectors. Members include Deutsche Bank, America's Foundation, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Open Society, and a number of other foundations and business institutions, RBC Capital Markets being one of them. And before I ask Nicole to come up, I just want to highlight that she, too, we're going to be talking about changing the game tonight. And Nicole's a game changer. In her past position, she served as executive director of the University of the West Indies Development and Endowment Fund. I like the West Indies part of that. You know, so did you. And under her leadership, through leveraging new investments and creating comprehensive partnerships between the university communities, philanthropic organizations globally, and the corporate sector, under her leadership, the fund increased its endowment from $48 million to over $500 million in a matter of 3 years. That's like game-changing stuff, right? Let me say that again. In a matter of 3 years, going from $48 million to over $500 million. And while in that leadership position, she established the Center for Caribbean Philanthropy. So let's welcome Nicole Sharp as she's going. I told her, just put your Oprah hat on. This is your show. I don't know about you all, but the lights are kind of like hot, so I'm glad I'm going to step to the side and go dry off in the back. But I'd like to welcome Nicole, who's going to kind of facilitate us for the evening. Welcome.
Thank you, Sean. Good evening, everybody.
Good evening.
As Sean mentioned, I am the director of Black Male Donor Collaborative. Our focus primarily is to improve the academic outcomes of black boys in New York initially, and then we're hoping to go national. So being here and being a part of the campaign is always a pleasure and a joy for me. I am very excited to have the fortune to introduce Dr. Pinkett. After reading his book, and I don't know if everybody had the opportunity, it really makes you reflect on your own life and the things that you've done and the choices and the decisions that you make in moving your career and your personal life. So I want to invite you all to really take this opportunity to have a personal conversation with him and the rest of the panelists, because I think that there's so much to learn when you sit down with others, especially those who are successful, and be able to talk to them honestly and openly about where you are and where they were and where they're going and how you could relate to your own life experience. And I hope everybody could hear me clearly. Before I introduce Dr. Pinkett, I just need to let everybody know that we are being recorded. So please be mindful of that.
I'll also let folks know that the book is available for sale outside.
Okay. Right. So I say please indulge, purchase the book. Part of it talks about, I don't know if it mentioned this Seven Habits of Effective People. And I know that's the wrong title, but Steve Covey's book. And for us people of color, persons of color, African Americans, this book has become a nice little guide as far as really looking at how to strategically transform your career, take it through the highs and lows, because I think all of our careers, they don't necessarily go like this. They have ups and downs depending on sacrifices that you make for family. And so I definitely encourage you to get the book and read it, because it was wonderful. It was absolutely great. So, without further ado, I'm going to introduce Dr. Randall Pinkett. He is the founder. Randall Pinkett has established himself as an entrepreneur, scholar, author, and speaker. He is the founder, chairman, and CEO of BCT Partners, a multi-million dollar consultant firm based in Newark, New Jersey, that specializes in information technology, organizational development, and public policy. Dr. Pinkett holds 5 degrees, including a BS in electrical engineering from Rutgers University, where he competed on the track field. Wow. Sorry. The track field team as a high jumper and long jumper. To have that kind of academic discipline and do sports is impressive. My daughter's venturing down that road. He holds an MS in computer science from the University of Oxford in England, an MS in electrical engineering, an MBA and PhD from MIT. Most notably, he was the first and only African American to receive a Rhodes Scholarship at Rutgers University and was the winner of NBC's hit reality television show, The Apprentice, with Donald Trump. Dr. Pinkett has been featured on national televised programs such as The Today Show, Live with Regis and Kelly, Nightline, and Larry King Live. In 2009, he was named to New Jersey Governor John Corzine's official shortlist as a potential front running mate for Lieutenant Governor of New Jersey. He is the author of Campus CEO, The Student Entrepreneur's Guide to Launching a Multi-Million Dollar Business, and No Money Down CEO, How to Start Your Dream Business with Literal No Cash, and co-author of Black Faces in White Places, The 10 Game-Changing Strategies to Achieve Success and Find Greatness, which was named one of the top black books of 2010. I would say one of the top books, because it should be read by all. Born in Philadelphia and raised in New Jersey, Dr. Pinkett is a proud member of Alpha Phi Alpha Fraternity Incorporated, and attends First Baptist Church in Somerset, New Jersey, where he resides. He's happily married with a wife, Zahara, and they are both proud parents of their daughter, Amira. Dr. Pinkett firmly believes that for those to whom much is given, much is expected. So throughout his endeavors, he places great emphasis on his desire to give back to the community. Dr. Pinkett?
Thank you. Look forward to working with you. All right. Good afternoon, everyone. Or actually, good evening, everyone. Let's try that one more time. Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
There we go. Let me begin by thanking Nicole for the introduction and for your moderation, which will ensue once I get through my opening remarks, as well as to a number of other people I want to recognize. High on the list is Sean Dove, our director of the Campaign for Black Male Achievement. Sean is a good friend, someone whom I admire tremendously, and above all, in this context, I admire him for the leadership he's demonstrated for black men and black boys. So please give Sean a round of applause. To the panelists that I will look forward to engaging with, Susan Taylor Batten, an old friend from her days at the Annie E. Casey Foundation, Chandra Anderson, Roger Blissett, and Michael Lewis, all of whom you'll hear from later on in the program. But I'm going to open up with remarks to frame the dialogue, but also frame the reason why we're gathered here, which is black faces in white places. And needless to say, I don't profess to be an expert on the issues affecting black men and black boys, but I do profess to have been a black boy and now a black man. I don't know if that qualifies me, but at least gives me a modicum of qualification. I hope to learn as much tonight as I endeavor to impart. And so I don't expect to have all the answers. I expect to have my own ideas. And I'm looking forward to being challenged on those ideas. I welcome that, in fact, disagreement, differing perspectives, as well as perhaps reinforcement of the very ideas that I come to the table with. The book itself is the work product of interviews with dozens of African Americans, we'll call them accomplished African Americans, many of whom were black men. I mean, they were all African American, but we had a good number of black men who stepped up to conduct interviews. Among them, Kevin Powell, who many of you will know if you've done any work in the area of black male achievement, Roland Martin from CNN, Benjamin Jealous, president of the NAACP, Don Thompson, the president of McDonald's, Hill Harper, Reverend Otis Moss, who succeeded Jeremiah Wright at Trinity in Chicago, Mayor Cory Booker, Jeff Johnson. So it's that's just a short list. But it gives you a feel for the individuals that we engaged that led to the final book that we'll discuss. The last thing I'll say is that here in the final day of Black History Month, I've attempted to orchestrate remarks that both speak to the theme, black faces in white places, speak to the campaign around black men and black boys, but also speak to Black History Month. And so for the points I'm bringing, I'm going to give examples of what I'll describe as some historical and some modern day black men who I see as black history makers, or at least are on the progression to making history. And so I'll be drawing and inferencing their examples throughout my remarks. Now, I was asked earlier what was the idea for the book. And needless to say, it was originally envisioned as an autobiography by myself and my co-author, Jeffrey Robinson, who's my roommate from college, my business partner, the best man at my wedding, the godfather to my children, the list goes on. He and I are closer than blood brothers. But the publishing community did not like our stories. I can get into the reasons why, perhaps. But needless to say, we remixed the project and engaged the voices of the individuals I've mentioned, among others. And that gave rise to what is now recognized as the 10 game-changing strategies. And I believe we've shed light on a dynamic that I don't think is a mystery or a secret, but one that perhaps hasn't been given as much attention as it deserves, and that is the dynamic of being a black face in a white place. How many of you have ever been a black face in a white place? Fair. I would argue that whether you attended an HBCU or an HBCS, y'all know what an HBCS? Historically Black Cafeteria Section. Some of you know what I'm talking about. Whether you attended an HBCU or an HBCS, then at some point in your career, if you've progressed at any modicum, you've experienced what it means to be a black face in a white place. And this book, at some level, and I'm going to be referencing a whole lot of books, but I'm going to do a visual here. These are the books I referenced to prepare my remarks. Yeah. And the first book I'm going to reference is Ellis Coase's book, The Rage of a Privileged Class. This might be the first talk on a book where I'm going to pull more content from other books than my own book. Go figure. So our book was envisioned as somewhat of a re-examination of what Coase examined, which was the 20th century rage as he described it. And the book is called The Rage of a Privileged Class. He changed the subtitle. It was originally, Why Do Prosperous Blacks Still Have the Blues? And then he changed the title a year later to Why Are Middle Class Blacks So Angry? Very telling title. Let me read to you an excerpt from Coase's work, which I think actually speaks to the dynamic we endeavor to describe. Despite its very evident prosperity, much of America's black middle class is in excruciating pain. And that distress, although most of the country does not see it, illuminates a serious American problem, the problem of the broken covenant of the pact, ensuring that if you work hard, get a good education, and play by the rules, you will be allowed to advance and to achieve the limits of your ability. Again and again, I spoke with people who have every accoutrement of success, but I heard the same plaintive declaration, always followed by various versions of an unchanging and urgently put question. I have done everything I was supposed to do. I have stayed out of trouble with the law, gone to the right schools, and worked myself nearly to death. What more do they want? Why in God's name won't they accept me as a full human being? Why am I pigeonholed into a black job? Why am I constantly treated as if I were a drug addict, a thief, or a thug? Why am I still not allowed to aspire to the same things every white person in America takes as a birthright? Why, when I most want to be seen, am I suddenly rendered invisible? Excerpt from Ellis Coase, which speaks to the dynamic of being a black face in a white place. And suffice it to say that I would argue many black boys and many black men are going to find themselves wrestling with these very questions. I know it was the case for me. Now, for the professionals in this room who find or have found themselves as black faces in white places, what does that look like? Getting back to Coase's remarks, you know, it looks like the following. You know, you're better educated and better prepared than any generation before you. You've got top grades from a top school and graduated with top grades. You graduated magna cum laude or summa cum laude or thank you, Lorde, but you still made it through. At times, you've had to work twice as hard, overcome twice as many obstacles, deal with twice as many issues just to be considered equal at times with your counterparts. You know what it's like to be perceived as if you speak for the entire black community. If you're wrong, we're all wrong. If you fail, we all fail. If you're right, you're the exception. Which suggests that if you are a successful black face in a white place in America in 2011, that suggests that your game is tight. That you work day and night. That you can seldom be wrong, you must always be right. And that makes you like a bright ray of light, or perhaps a rising star about to take flight. In fact, some might say that you're simply out of sight, because you've proven over and over and over again that you can overcome any plight. To obstacles and barriers, you break through with might. To achievement, you bring grace without spite. To sore eyes, you are a very welcome sight, and somehow you just keep rising and rising and rising like the wind beneath a kite. In fact, why don't we just say what JJ said on Good Times, that you are dynamite. Where's Sean? You got your spoken word, man. So is there a 21st century rage of a privileged class? It's an interesting question. I would submit that the answer is yes. Or at best, if this rage has indeed somehow or some way been diminished from what Coase described in the last century, that it is only because African Americans have become more adept, more comfortable, and more competent at navigating these environments where we are still underrepresented. Stated differently, more adept at playing the game. That we use the game in our book as a metaphor for any competitive environment, as a game of politics, a game of philanthropy, a game of business, a game of education, a game of journalism. The list goes on. Here's an excerpt from a reaction to our book that was written by someone who I don't know, but I found it on the internet. But I found it to be quite insightful. I'm going to put it in the next book. So, this is the excerpt. So, what is the game that black people must play? It's written in 2011. I must say, Because it is a game that every black person who works in a predominantly white environment learns to play if he or she plans to survive. It's the accommodation game. The question that black people face is not whether to accommodate white people. Most black people accepted a long time ago that they will have to play by the rules of the game. The question black people ask themselves is not if, but how much do I accommodate white people? The game asks every black person to surrender a piece of his or her humanity to get along. We make the accommodations to keep our jobs. We make the accommodations that, so that we can hold on to our homes. We make the accommodations so that our kids will have access to quality schools. And we hope and pray that they will not have to play the game. And some of that I agree with, some of it I don't agree with. But needless to say, for that to have been written in the modern day, juxtaposed against what we heard from Ellis Coase in the 20th century, some clearly would agree or at least argue that there is the 21st century rage, that there's a game underlying our competitive environments and a 21st century challenge that still persists. So how do you resolve this rage? What does it mean to play the game in the new millennium? How do you navigate environments where you are challenged based on racial stereotypes, low expectations, perhaps prejudice and discrimination? Not very easy questions to discuss publicly and openly, but we're going to get into it today. These are the very questions that we wrestled with when we wrote the book, which gave rise through the interviews to the 10 game-changing strategies in black faces and white places. I'm going to give you a snapshot of a few of the strategies. There's 10. I'm not going to go through all 10. I don't have enough time. But I am going to try to touch upon a few. So what are the strategies? And as I was mentioning in the introduction, we did take an approach to the book, as did Stephen Covey, to kind of identify these generalizable, simple, but easily applied strategies based on the interviews and based on our own experience. First and foremost is strategy one. Strategy one is to establish a strong identity and purpose. Establish a strong identity and purpose. Identity and purpose are the foundation. Each of the strategies builds off of one another. Identity answers the questions, who am I? What makes me unique? Fill in the blank. I am blank. That is your identity, or at least how you define your identity. We have multiple identities, our gender identity, our national identity, our spiritual or religious identity, our professional identity, our cultural identity. We argue that it is a solid cultural identity that is perhaps of paramount importance for black men and black boys, particularly given the heightened sensitivity and attention to race in American society. That our identity, or on the topic of identity, if you don't define yourself, somebody else will define you. And in this environment, more often than not, on negative terms. Are you with me? Purpose answers the question, why do I exist? Where am I going? Why have I been placed on this planet, on this earth? And you serve multiple purposes. One purpose could be as a loving and responsible parent. Another purpose could be to uplift and inspire others through music. Another purpose might be to mentor young people in your neighborhood. Your purpose is something we see and define as a higher calling of the passion and the God-given gifts that you've been blessed with. Why is purpose so important? Because if you don't know where you're going, any road will lead you there. If you don't know where you're going, any road will lead you there. Stated differently, identity is your anchor. It's what grounds you. Purpose is your compass. It's what guides you. Jonas Salk once said that good parents give their children two things, roots and wings. Roots to know where home is, and wings to fly away and exercise what's been taught them. Identity is your roots. Purpose are your wings. Without the two, in the midst of an environment that might seek to tell you what you cannot do, might seek to stereotype you, might seek to define you on other terms, you're like a leaf in the wind, just blowing around, without any centeredness and without any sense of direction. So, getting back to Black History Month, when I think about identity and purpose, as an example, I think about individuals such as a black man who had as many identities as he had names. I'm going to quiz you. As a child, he was called the N-word so many times he believed it was his given name. At school in Lansing, Michigan, even as he earned top grades and was elected class president, a teacher still discouraged him from becoming a lawyer because he was black. He escaped the limiting racial identity imposed upon him in Michigan to the underworld of Harlem, New York. There he remade himself, redefined his identity in the lawless and isolated image of the black hustler, bootlegging liquor and guiding white men to black prostitutes. Does anyone know who I'm talking about? All right. On this experience, he says the following, his words, not my words. There I was in Harlem streets among all the rest of the hustlers. I couldn't sell reefers, the dope squad. Detectives were too familiar with me. I was a true hustler, uneducated, unskilled at anything honorable, and I considered myself nervy and cunning enough to live by my wits, exploiting any prey that presented itself. I would risk just about anything. After years of reading and study in prison, he reconsidered his racial identity in light of history, philosophy, and the teachings of the Nation of Islam that regarded black people as an original and good people and whites as an aberration meant to spread evil in the world. Later, in Mecca, he dug more firmly into his black identity, feeling brotherhood with white Muslims, feeling sisterhood with white Muslims, and returned to the U.S. with a message of racial tolerance and an impartial commitment to truth and justice. Today, he is regarded as one of the greatest African Americans in history. Time magazine named his autobiography one of the 10 most influential books of the 20th century. I'm talking about a black man who was born Malcolm Little, died Alhaj Malik El-Shabazz, but is popularly known as none other than Malcolm X. Some of y'all got that right. You passed part one of the test. Takeaways. What is the best way to establish a strong identity and purpose for black boys, black men, black anyone for that matter? The answer, in our opinion, is strategy two. Obtain broad exposure. Obtain broad exposure. Look at his story. Exposure to role models. Stated differently, look at Malcolm's story. Exposure to reading. Exposure to study. Exposure to people, places, possibilities. Over the course of his life. That is what shaped his identity. And so the tactics that we imply nowadays, helping young boys and black men to participate in cultural events, rites of passage, the kinds of things Sean supports, exposure to role models who reflect their cultural background, and above all, teaching our young people their history. That we have got to do a better job of instilling a sense of history in our young people, and we cannot rely on what is being taught in the schools. We cannot rely solely on what is being taught in the schools. That our young people must see both the product of black success and the process of black success. That as they see people like my twin brother, Kevin Garnett. Somebody was thinking that. You were thinking it. Fair enough. As they see the product of success, in individuals like him or President Obama or whomever else we might identify, they have to also see the story behind the story, the process that got them there, to understand that nothing in life worth having comes easy. And only when you understand the process do you have an appreciation for the product. Moving on, strategy one, establish a strong identity and purpose. Another snippet, strategy three. Actually, I gave you a flavor for strategy two. I'm actually going to do okay. So strategy one, establish a strong identity and purpose. Strategy two, obtain broad exposure. Strategy three, demonstrate excellence. Now, what is excellence? We define it according to four facets, you might say. Facet number one, passion. Those things you're naturally drawn to. Facet two, your gifts, what you're naturally able to do. Facet three, discipline. Good old-fashioned, don't be afraid to roll up your sleeves and get your hands dirty, hard work. Applied to the things you've been blessed with. Facet four, empowering beliefs, such that perhaps the most empowering belief is that of faith. Faith in yourself and faith in what you can accomplish. Take those four facets, passion, gifts, discipline, faith. Combine those four, you'll find excellence. Combine those four, you will find excellence. However, excellence only puts you in the game. In fact, without excellence, you're not in the game, you're on the bench. You're on the bench. Let me be even clearer. Because all of it begins with passion and gifts, period. What you're passionate about and what you've been gifted to do. I'll give you an example, and Sean can appreciate this. I have yet to go to a church or a school that has a chorus or a choir that doesn't have at least one person who is passionate about singing but not gifted in singing. And that person always gets a solo. Okay, so if you're thinking, not my church, not my school, then it must be you I'm talking about. Okay. So my point, in addition to identity and purpose, we believe any effort to promote the educational achievement of black boys and black men, the career development, the professional development, the motivation of black boys and black men has to begin with a conversation about helping them to identify their passion and their gifts. When I think about, and I talked earlier about how we see your purpose as a higher calling of your passion and your gifts. When I think about an example of a black male who found passion and gifts and transformed his life, I think about individuals, and I forgot his book, but I did read it. Such as a black man who grew up in the Hollis area of Queens, your second quiz here. It was then known as the drug capital of Queens, New York. He had a natural gift for entrepreneurship, a natural gift. But early in his life, he channeled it directly and exclusively into dealing drugs. He began selling marijuana in middle school. For a long time, was a member of a local gang called the Seven Immortals. When he was 16, he shot someone who tried to rob him, was arrested twice on charges, and received a term of probation. But in 1977, while a student at the City University of New York, He attended a party at a small club where an MC was shouting out rhymes over a breakbeat, and at that instant, he found his passion. He knew his gift, but he found his passion. His words on that experience, not mine. These are his words from the book, which I'd hold up, but I don't have it. All the street entrepreneurship I'd learned, selling herb, faking hard cocaine, and staying out of jail, I decided to put it into promoting music. Who am I talking about? All right. Put him on a completely new trajectory. He would go on to become the founder of Def Jam Recordings, help launch the international cultural revolution known as hip-hop, and along with countless other ventures, Fat Farm, Def Comedy Jam, Def Poetry Jam, Run Athletics, I'm talking about the music and fashion mogul none other than Russell Simmons. When you find that intersection of your passion and your gifts, I believe you are at a juncture where you have the potential to make your greatest impact in society. And it is going back to strategy two. How do you find passion and gifts? Part of strategy three of what it means to demonstrate excellence. The answer is strategy two, once again, broad exposure. Exposure to opportunities to find what that passion is and what those gifts are. Knowing that if you don't find it, if you look long enough, it will find you. It will find you. My passion? Business. I sold lemonade as a kid, sold candy as a kid. I sold my toys to other kids in my neighborhood when I got tired of my toys. My mom found out and said, "You can't sell the toys. I bought them." She said, "If you're going to sell them, at least give me a cut." I told her no. So she shut me down, man. She shut me down completely. Stated differently, in the words of the great philosopher and scholar, Flavor Flav. I'm gonna wake y'all up. What we need is awareness. We can't get careless. Those are the words of Flavor Flav. Those are the words of Flavor Flav. Or in the words of Oprah Winfrey, perhaps more poignant. When you love what you do, you will never work another day in your life. I'll close this one out with my final quote from the book, the words of Randall Pinkett and Jeffrey Robinson. Experience is the best teacher. Exposure creates the best classroom. Exposure creates the best classroom. So I've given you the foundation of Black Faces in White Places. Strategy one, identity and purpose. Strategy two, broad exposure. Strategy three, demonstrate excellence. Those are the first three strategies. I'm going to cherry pick two more and wrap this up. Strategy five, which I wanted to touch on because of the work that Sean is doing, is called seek the wisdom of others. Seek the wisdom of others, knowing that perhaps the most effective way to seek the wisdom of another is through mentoring. And I don't want to spend too much time on here because last month was National Mentoring Month. You had a program here, Celebrate the Power of Mentoring, January 31st. But I don't want to underemphasize its importance by not giving sufficient voice to it. So I'm going to give you just one story that portrays the power of mentoring, which I know Sean will appreciate. When I think about the power of mentoring, I think about individuals such as a man who was born in Maryland in 1978, young guy. When he was 3 years old, his father died in front of him of acute epiglottitis. His mother, hoping for a better future for her family, made great sacrifices to send him and his sisters to a private school. Caught between two worlds, the affluence of his classmates and the struggles of his neighbors, he began to act out, succumbing to bad grades, suspensions, and delinquencies. Desperate to reverse his behavior, his mother sent him to Valley Forge Military School in Pennsylvania. Does anyone know who I'm talking about? Ooh, this audience is on the money! After trying to escape from military school 4 times in 5 days, it was largely the influence of mentors that led him to decide he would stop railing against the system, become accountable for his actions, and aspire to lead soldiers in the U.S. Army. On this experience, he says the following, his words, not my words. As I started to think seriously about how I could become the person I wanted to be, I looked around at some of the people who'd had the biggest impact on my life. Aside from family and friends, the men I most trusted all had something in common. They all wore the uniform of the United States of America. I thought about Lieutenant Colonel Murnane, my 10th and 11th grade history and social studies teacher, who lit a fire in me about the importance of public service. I thought about Rear Admiral Hill, the former superintendent of the Naval Academy, who taught me an important lesson about leadership. I thought about Colonel Billy Murphy and Sergeant Major Harry Harris, who demanded excellence from every unit, every platoon, and every cadet. Because of them, my next decision was clear. He's finishing high school. I wanted to stay at Valley Forge and attend its junior college, receive my associate's degree, and become a second lieutenant in the Army. He would go on to graduate Phi Theta Kappa from the Valley Forge Military Academy, graduate Phi Beta Kappa from Johns Hopkins University, where he was named a Rhodes Scholar. Today, he is a financial analyst for Citigroup, a public speaker, a best-selling author, and an advocate for youth, talking about a black man named Wes Moore. Some of you know him. Some of you just got to meet him. The story of Wes Moore, the takeaways that I have, there's multiple roles of a mentor, or shall I say multiple potential roles of a mentor. Guide, teacher, counselor, confidant, sponsor, peer, coach, role model, the list goes on. And it's not that one person necessarily has to fill all of these roles, but rather, any interaction that we have with a young person in any of those roles has the potential to have a profound impact. Wes's story, there's no one person who just stands out as being the mentor to Wes. It's a series of shades of mentorship of men who stepped in the right place at the right time to give the right word, the right advice, the right example, the right encouragement, the right challenge, which to me only strengthens the need for us, particularly men, particularly black men, to step up as mentors. When I was in college, I would go to conferences and I would hear over and over again, we need more blacks to get graduate degrees. And when I entered college, I was like, I'm not going anywhere past the bachelor's, forget graduate school. But the message eventually stuck in. I said, you know what? I can get a master's. And when I got into the master's program, I said, you know what? I can get a PhD. My point being, I think all the efforts that are happening to heighten awareness around the importance of mentoring are exactly what needs to be happening. Meaning, we have to continue to deliver the message that we need our men to step up so that that message will ultimately sink in, that we have more of our men stepping up to be mentors. And I say that from another standpoint. My wife and I are right now in the process of becoming certified as foster and adoptive parents. And, fair enough. And, thank you. Wait till we're done. You got to pass the class. But it was through my work related to helping black boys and black men that it was placed on my spirit. It just was placed on my spirit. And I said to my wife, I said, we should adopt a black boy. We got room. We got all the things that a young man would want. So let's open up our home. And so I started to say, if it can influence me, it can influence many other people. And I think that's exactly what needs to be happening. Lastly, I want to touch on Strategy 8. I got to hit on this one, because this one's near and dear to my heart. Strategy 8, the last one I'm going to touch on. Well, actually, second to last. I'm going to squeeze in one more. Think and act like an entrepreneur. And I haven't really connected the dots. I don't have time for that. Get the book. That'll connect the dots for you. Strategy 8, think and act like an entrepreneur. That is, you all hear that and immediately think, oh, he's telling folk to go out and start businesses. No, I'm not, actually. I'm saying think like an entrepreneur. That entrepreneurship is not just something you do. It's a way that you think. And I believe it is the defining mindset of the 21st century. More specifically, what is the mindset? Creativity, resourcefulness, courage, resilience, and passion. Getting back to our earlier conversation, I believe our young men naturally embody these very characteristics. I mean, think about it. I mean, I look at young men today. They can watch TV, watch YouTube, listen to the radio, play Wii, answer the home phone, answer the cell phone, take a picture, post to Facebook, tweet to Twitter, eat dinner, and do homework all at the same time. That's entrepreneurial. I don't know what is. They can make it through a semester on turkey and cheese sandwiches with no turkey and no cheese. Somebody knows what I'm talking about. Okay, maybe you don't. I know something about that. And more to the point, there is a long and growing list of very successful companies started by some very young people. You all knew Microsoft was founded by Bill Gates when he was a student. That Dell was founded by Michael Dell, University of Texas. Did you know Nike was founded by a student? Did you know Pizza Hut was founded by a student? Did you know Subway was founded by a student? Did you know Kinko's was founded by a student? You knew that Russell Simmons started at the University of New York, because I told you. P. Diddy started at Howard University. Shout out to Howard University. Did you know that Federal Express, overnight mail, founded by a student? The founder, Fred Smith, wrote a paper in a class on the concept of overnight mail. The professor gave him a C. Said it will never happen. If that professor knew then what they know now, they could have made some money off that deal. Point is, I believe that entrepreneurship is a very natural entry point for our young men. Not only because it taps into popular culture. You know, you see the examples of Michael Jordan owning the Wizards, of Isaiah Thomas owning the Raptors, of Usher owning the Cavaliers, of Jay-Z owning the Nets, of Nelly, Mr. It's Getting Hot in Here, or It's Getting Hot in Her, owning the Charlotte Bobcats. So, I mean, it taps into popular culture. But there's also a natural energy right now. 2/3 of college students say they intend to become entrepreneurs in their careers, according to Students in Free Enterprise. According to the Young Entrepreneur Foundation, 90% of high school teachers and guidance counselors say their students are interested in becoming entrepreneurs. And according to the Kauffman Foundation, African Americans are 50% more likely to start a business than whites. And according to Kauffman, these are their words, not mine, the greatest potential economic impact is among black males. They say for a given amount of entrepreneurial investment, black males stand to see the greatest improvement in their economic status. Stated differently, we need more black billionaires. Now, I volunteer myself to be one. You are not feeling my jokes tonight. Man. But hopefully we'll see some more young black men along that path. Last story, my last example, which speaks to the power of entrepreneurship. You know, we often theorize about what if our young men could put as much energy into law or medicine or business as they do into entertainment or sports. We often wonder what that would look like, right? We have a great example. I'm going to give it to you. My last example. Individuals such as a man who was born the 6th of 10 children, born to a father who was a General Motors assembly worker and a mother who was a school custodian. He knew a lot about discipline as a basketball player. In his own words, his words, not mine, I would practice basketball all day long. That discipline led him to lead Michigan State to the NCAA Men's Championship, the Los Angeles Lakers to 5 NBA championships. But it was the application of this discipline, not to basketball, but to business, that in my opinion makes him a modern black history maker. I don't know how many of you remember where you were in 1991 when this man announced that he was HIV positive. And if you recall, in 91, HIV was a death sentence. He could have easily had held his head down, wallowed in self-pity, embarrassment, and shame, but he didn't. This man, rather than sitting on his hands, today is arguably one of the most successful African Americans in business. I'm going to read you a short list of what he's done since retiring from basketball. He owns chains of Starbucks, chains of Sony Theaters, chains of TGI Fridays. He is part owner of the Lakers he used to play for. He owns chains of Burger Kings. He owns chains of the American food company that supplies Burger King. He owns a real estate company, an urban investment fund, a workforce solutions company, chains of 24-hour fitness clubs called Signature Clubs, a consulting business on how to reach urban consumers, a marketplace in Jersey City, commercials for Jackson Hewitt tax preparation, commercials for Rent-A-Center, spokesperson for GlaxoSmithKline. He employs 30,000 people. I'm talking about Magic Johnson. Magic Johnson! It's a tough audience. I'm going to call you out on it, too. So what's the message here? Twofold. Entrepreneurship as a hook for our young men. Financial literacy as a component of that. Responsible financial management. And looking at ways that we can parlay or combine the great momentum around black male achievement with the momentum around entrepreneurship. That the folks like the Kauffman Foundation, the National Foundation for Teaching Entrepreneurship, Junior Achievement, the list goes on. All these organizations tapping into the very work of people like Ashawn Dove and people that are represented in this room. So I'm gonna wrap this up. Wrap it up, Mr. Apprentice. I've given you 5 strategies, actually better than I thought. Strategy 1, identity and purpose. 2, broad exposure. 3, excellence. 5, wisdom of others. 8, think and act like an entrepreneur. The sum total of these 10 game-changing strategies, of which you've gotten a glimpse, speaks to what it means to resolve the 21st century rage of a privileged class. To walk within environments where you do not see a reflection of yourself, but to know who you are, where you're going, and what you seek to accomplish. With that, let me close on a word on strategy 10, which is give back generously. Strategy 10 speaks to all the preceding 9 strategies, because each of the 9 preceding strategies implies a way of giving back. Strategy 1, teach a black boy about his history. Strategy 2, expose a black boy to horizons and possibilities he wasn't aware of. Strategy 3, encourage a black boy to pursue his passion first. Strategy 5, be a mentor to a black boy. Strategy 8, invest in a black boy to start a business. It is by doing something for ourselves that we become game changers. It is by doing something for somebody else that we redefine the game. So I invite you to visit the website, redefinethegame.com, because we are going to be launching a campaign, hopefully with support of the Open Society. That is the campaign to redefine the game, equipping America with the tools and the tactics to do something for themselves, to find success, and something for someone else, to find greatness. In conclusion, when we implement Strategy 10, give back generously, it is then and only then that those of us who've got game can make sure, if there's a young boy who's got game, that nobody can run game on his game. That he will have an equal opportunity to learn the game, play the game, master the game, and win the game, because we redefined the game. Such that when that black boy grows older, and he's walking through the halls of some major corporation, and somebody walks up to him and says, "You got game?" he can look them in the eye and confidently reply, "Not only do I have game, but my people have had game since the beginning of time. In fact, I don't know what game you're talking about. As far as I can tell, the game's over." God bless you. Thank you. Put my props away and let the panel ensue.
Okay, he said we are a tough audience, so we gotta give him another.
What's tough?
Right here, right here.
You there?
Yeah. I think that was excellent. Now we need to figure out, Sean, how to get this this message out to every young black boy, how to broadcast it and make sure that they hear what you had to say, because it was definitely informative. Today, we have a wonderful panel who is going to join Dr. Pinkett up on the stage. We're going to start, and I'm going to introduce you, and if you could just join, I'll appreciate it. Our first panelist I'm going to call to the seat is Chandra Anderson. She's the interim president of the 21st Century Foundation and the president of Anderson Consultants. She raised approximately $1 billion during 20 years of fundraising. The 21st Century Foundation works to advance the welfare of black community through strategic and collective grant making, special initiatives, research, donor education, and donor services. 21CF has been in existence for over four decades and has extensive experience in organizing, convening, and grant making, and has made a trusted friend in the black communities, meeting standards to efficiently and effectively deliver our mission, has also earned the trust of the philanthropic community. Anderson Consults is a fundraising firm for nonprofit organizations that specializes in developing strategies, helping to implement those strategies that secure necessary resources to carry out the next phase of the organization's mission. Ms. Anderson. Next, I'm going to ask Roger Blissett to join the stage. He's the vice president and branch manager of both Royal Bank of Canada's New York branches, primarily focused on institutional clients and capital market activities. Mr. Blissett also holds the title of managing director of U.S. strategies for Royal Bank of Canada. As branch manager, Mr. Blissett has a leadership role in actively designing and overseeing the businesses conducted in these branches. Roger Blissett. If I could ask someone, can I get some water? Because I'm dry. Susan Taylor Batten. Thank you. Joined.
It's hot up here.
The associate and the lights.
It's hot.
Joined the Association of Black Foundation Executives as president and CEO in January 2009. Prior to joining ABFI, Ms. Batten was a senior associate at Annie Casey Foundation. Ms. Batten has more than 20 years of experience in directing, evaluating, and advising both public and foundation-related efforts to improve outcomes for children and families. At Casey, Ms. Batten served as staff to the Community Change Initiative Unit, which provides communities and other partners with information, resources, and supports to help transform neighborhoods into family-supportive environments. Susan. She gave me one. And this is a joy and a pleasure. We have a young man, a student, Michael Lewis. He is a member of the Black Male Initiative Program at CUNY Hunter College. He is a CUNY Hunter alumni and graduate with honors, and he's also an actor and radio show host. Michael, please join us.
everyone. All right.
Okay, so what I'm going to do is ask each panelist to give their remarks to the presentation that Dr. Pinkett presented, and then after that we're going to engage in a wonderful conversation. Chandra, if y'all could just go in the way I called you up, that'll be great.
Okay. Good evening.
There we are. Okay, good evening. First, I'd just like to start by thanking Sean and the team, Rashid and Haley, for all the work you do here and for the work around the campaign for Black Male Achievement, the panelists, the moderator, and Randall, all I can say is I wish this book was around when I was starting out. It's a wonderful book. And I think it's a reminder that racism exists no matter what level you're at, no matter where you are. And I want to thank you for offering concrete strategies for addressing things that allow us to make progress and also stay positive. I think when I think about, you know, my own journey in my profession, I'm a fundraiser. There are times when you're not clear about whether it is racism or perceived racism. And in a sense, it doesn't really matter. It's what you feel. You feel that that is the case. And I'm going to kind of start my comments just talking about some of the things that I think helped me through and helped me, you know, move to a certain level. And also, once in that level, make a different kind of transition. You heard in my bio that I worked for organizations. I worked at the United Way, where I was chief development officer. Then I went back into my community, worked at the Apollo Theater, which was a little bit of a difference. I had a $100 million portfolio at United Way, a 60-person staff, and then I went to a very small organization where there was one grant writer who cried every day. And I wanted to learn how to build an organization because I knew at some point I would consult. And it was around September 11th when I was chief development officer at the United Way. We had a $500 million fund. And right after that, I just felt like I wanted to do something different with my life. It was the idea of purpose. And I think that was attached to identity. So I wanted to go back into the community and teach what I had learned about fundraising. And it ended up that I learned a lot of things. And it was very different. It's very different raising money in an organization that has a strong fundraising culture and building one from scratch. And it's the difference, I think, that if you ask a poor mother, if you ask a woman to raise a child, a woman and a man, and they have a $100,000 income, I think there are some strategies that they can tell you that work. But ask a mother who raises a child on $10,000. I don't know if there are case studies and strategies for that. You'd have to actually go and ask people who've done that. So I think that there's a learning on both sides. But the thing that I wanted to just kind of talk a little bit about is some of the emotional things, because a lot of it is emotional. And I think Randall touched on the fact that excellence and being good at the technique, that puts you in the game. So at a certain point, everybody is excellent and really good at what they do. And then what is it that distinguishes you? And you look at a player like Tiger Woods, and you know, not only is he really good at playing the game, but he's emotionally strong. And what is it that keeps you in there and makes you emotionally strong? There's something called emotional IQ. People have heard of that. And you know, it's been named as probably the leading characteristic of leadership, so that you know who you are, what you're good at, and what you're not. So you know what you do, you know how to surround yourself with people around you who are good at the things you're not good at. And actually, it takes a lot of, I would say, emotional stability to come up with that formula. Because a lot of times we think we're good at things, and we think we have to be good at everything in order to achieve. And we can get lost in that. And so what is it that you have to do to get emotional IQ and self-awareness? As I made the transition from executive to entrepreneur, which I spent a lot of time in Jamaica, we call that popping down. So I had to pop down for a little while. So I had to actually, you know, give up my job that where I earned a lot of money and start a business from scratch. I had to give up all the competencies that I had gained and learn how to be an entrepreneur, which was not my strength. I knew how to run, you know, an organization. I knew how to have a $5 million budget and 60 people working for me. But to have to do every single thing myself and work from home and figure out the taxes and all of those things, and then to do it on very little money. So to make it so that my business earned money, I had to change the way that I worked. I had to change what I had become over 20 years. And so I went to a shrink to make that adjustment. I was a stressed out executive. You know, I wasn't really happy in my job, couldn't put my hand on it. I was kind of like a little grumbly and kind of blaming my boss for not doing what I needed him to do. And the shrink helped me realize that it was time for me to make a change and take my own risk and do the things that were important to me. And that meant giving up the big job. And what I was facing was a fear of being poor. That was the first time anyone had ever asked me, what are you afraid of? No one had ever asked me that question my whole career and my whole life. And I was able to answer it honestly. You know, I had been through leadership development. I had been coached. I was a coach myself. And a lot of those things actually helped me develop some level of emotional intelligence so I could get to the problem very quickly. But it did take going to therapy and sitting with the therapist for a period of about 2 years to just work through some issues. And she helped me make that transition. She helped me learn to stand on the edge and be uncertain about the future. Essentially, that was what was happening anyway. You could have lost, you can lose your job, okay? And the future is very uncertain, especially in today's, you know, time. But it could happen at any time. So a lot of what was I was experiencing was perceived, wasn't real, but it was the way I felt, and I had to face that. I think the other thing is education. You would talk about, there's all kinds of education. You know, certainly the formal education is really important. There are tons of people who can talk to you about that. But I think understanding the craft, and in my case, it was understanding things that weren't published. So if you look at what I do in terms of bringing people together, wealthy people with poor people, wealthy people to give their money to poor people, understanding the motivation of the wealthy is really important, but also understanding what poor people need and what makes them benefit, what makes them change, and also what they have to offer. Because I think there's a perception, we talk about giving back. Well, there's really an exchange. It's not just a giving back. I would say, just like I said at the Apollo, when I went to work there, what I've learned from poor people is probably more than they've gotten from me, which is really, really interesting. That wasn't my expectation. And I think, you know, a lot of times when we talk about philanthropy, about charity, that we miss the boat when we, you know, think that we're doing all of the giving. And I heard Randall say it when he talked about giving to young people and what you get back out of that. So it is an exchange. So I think that that's really important. I wanted to focus on the giving back generously as bullet number 10. Of course, that's the work that I do. And there are many ways to do it. You know, you talk about time, giving talent. And I love the way that Randall described it, the whole idea of tithing being 10% of both your time and your money. And I think throughout your whole career, I mean, there are people who start when they're children. You know, the parents get them in the habit by having them take their allowance and divide it up and make sure that they're giving back in addition to, you know, buying toys or clothes or whatever it is that they're doing. So that's good habit. It's a habit, something that you get in the habit of doing. I wanted to just kind of close by talking a little bit about philanthropy and the organization that I work in, 21CF. We work to identify nonprofit organizations in poor communities who, you know, we bring them to the attention of mainstream philanthropy, individuals, foundations. We've worked a lot with OSI and Sean and Rashid, and allow others to make contributions to those organizations, building their capacity, their leadership, their structural capacity. I think what's really important is just recognizing that philanthropy is not events. There's another way to give. There's another way to give your money and to make a real impact beyond, you know, fundraisers and things like that. Those things are good, but other things are good too, and just writing a check or just being there for someone is really important. So I did want to make that distinction.
I guess I'm next, right? What I wanted to kind of focus on in the brief time I have, and I'm going to try and abbreviate my remarks because I think I really would like to get into a conversation with the audience and with the people on the panel. You know, I'm a son of immigrant parents, grew up in South Jamaica, Queens. My folks made it very clear to me what the expectations were of me in terms of their sacrifices and their interest in my focusing on education, as was said before. At a point in time when I didn't know what my, you know, purpose was, they helped me in terms of directing what that should be in terms of dedicating myself to my studies. And it was tough because, you know, growing up as a kid in South Jamaica, to many of the themes as were talked about in terms of the folks, the gentleman who grew up to be the leader of Def Jam, I mean, it wasn't cool to be a student, even back in the late 70s. It wasn't cool, and you were a target, and you were ostracized, and even though we were still very, very close in history to the movement in the 60s, it was beginning to rear its head that, you know, being bright wasn't something that was promoted, at least in some of the circles that I traveled with. It was cooler to be a part of a gang, quite honestly, to earn your stripes that way. But being from a household that made it clear that that was that, but your focus was on education, was very, very helpful. When I had the opportunity to go to one of the specialized schools in New York, but didn't quite make it, I had a choice to make. I could go to one of the, you know, the stronger schools in Queens, or sacrifice a summer and go to the specialized high school that I'd come close enough to getting into. And Roger at 13 would have made one choice, but the parents made that choice for me. And you know, I look back now, and you know, you realize that, you know, that was just critical. It made every difference in the world. From that school on to one of the smaller liberal arts schools in the Northeast, had the benefit of having mentors and colleagues like John Johnson in the audience and others here, who, you know, you were focused on getting through. But it was a community, you know. It was a community that was invested in each other doing well. And I think, you know, that theme is in direct and stark contrast to some of the themes that we're seeing now that proliferate our society in terms of individualism. And at the time, you didn't really kind of understand it. It was cool. There was a tradition that was formed in terms of the seniors, you know, investing in me, the sophomores, who are ahead of me, investing in me, my then turning around and investing in folks like Sean. But it worked in terms of, you know, you can't do but so much, but what you can do, you should do. Sometimes I think as we reflect back on our lives and what we do, we struggle in terms of grand impact as opposed to the small micro impacts. And I think, the experience at Wesleyan set me in motion to not losing sight of the horizon in terms of making the game-changing sort of contributions, but never forget what you can do on a micro level. Went on from Wesleyan to go to professional school, law school in the city at NYU, Worked hard. It wasn't easy. One of the things that I think people need to realize is the work that we do, regardless of what our passions are or what our calling is not easy work, right? A lot of it is done out of the limelight, in dark cubbyholes and libraries, but you got to put in the time to become excellent in what you do, because nobody's going to want to pay for anything that you're not expert at. But in addition to being expert and excellent in terms of your craft, you have to have what you talked about in terms of those wings and that confidence, because that's what people pay for, at least in my field. I'm now working as an investment banker, and they pay for confidence. Sometimes you can sell the confidence and not have the substance, unfortunately. We've seen that through the crisis. It's the marriage of skills and competency and confidence that people pay for. Now you reach a juncture in your life, though, if you're blessed to meet somebody that you can be your life mate and to start a family, that notwithstanding all of your commitment to community, you have to make some choices. The careers that many of us decide to go into are very demanding, and they're only 24 hours in a day, 7 days in the week. And not even for those of us who think of ourselves as supermen or superwomen, that's just the reality of time. And you have to make some hard choices. So you're focused on trying to learn your craft, but at the same time, you want to be the best husband, the best father you can be to the family. So, I kind of went into a cocoon for about 15 years, spending 80 to 100 hours a week, plus trying to be, the best father I could be, even though I was a bit of an absentee father because I was at work. Although those passions and that commitment to community, still rage inside of you, you have to make some difficult choices. And so it's no accident that, 15 years were spent trying to focus, always being very mindful of what was going on in my, instant community, but realizing that my number one focus was on my daughters and on my wife. As was the case, whatever I had an opportunity, whether at work or, in other efforts, I tried to do what I could. But that conflict raged for many, many years in terms of not doing enough, but trying to have the kind of peace to understand that you can only do what you can do. So 4 or 5 years ago, I went to a set of forums that was held by Sullivan and Cromwell and Goldman Sachs called Winning Strategies. And it happened at a time that just reignited a lot of interest I had in terms of addressing the issues of the achievement gap of African-American males. And from that, I was involved in the leadership team for the education working group of that effort that has resulted now in the Black Male Donor Collaborative, which I participate in under the stewardship of Nicole and other people. But that's a way for me to engage in a more meaningful way in terms of trying to really address those sorts of chronic issues. And we talk about this issue as an issue that afflicts our community, but it's an American tragedy. Mm-hmm. People are talking now about how ill-equipped our citizenry at large is to face the challenges of the 21st century. But if anybody was paying attention for the last 15, 20 years, if not more, you saw the disastrous impact on our community for that period of time. As Lottie Guinier said, we've been the canary in the coal mine when it comes to the failure of the public education system in this country, and it's coming home to roost, not to quote from Malcolm, but, So I think, just in summary, because I want to let everybody else speak, I think, what's core to my success stories, whether it be, entrepreneurship or entrepreneurship or giving back to the community, is to realize, what your limitations are, but never lose sight of the horizon of where you're going. I think it's critical that we, one of the things I used to challenge my teammates with in the education working group and with the Black Male Donor Collaborative is ask ourselves, what child have we helped today? We don't have to change the system overnight, but let's just focus on changing the trajectory of one person, right? And it sometimes the simplest challenge is the most poignant. So with that.
Great. Wow. Well, I too will be quick so we can get into conversation. I just want to start by thanking Sean for even asking me to be on this panel. I think it's pretty amazing, and to be sitting here with colleagues who are so accomplished, I still feel I'm a little bit of a pilot project. The man upstairs is working really hard to move me where I want to be. And you know, I prepared some thoughts, but just the concept of parents, and what did you say, Randall? They give you the purpose and something about the wings.
Roots and wings.
The roots and wings. And it just reminds me how, whether we're talking about our young black men, we're talking about black kids in general, which is what I have a passion about, we have got to stay focused on what's happening in the home and the issue of parent-child interaction. When I think about sort of where I get my foundation, it's back to my parents. A lot of this stuff is so inbred in us. You know, my dad, 40 years, New York City Board of Education, taught in Brownsville, Brooklyn, and ran youth centers at night. And when he wasn't doing that, he was running homework clubs, you know, in our basement, in our neighborhood in Long Island. I grew up in Long Island, New York. My mom, who was a nurse, a community nurse in a health center in Wyandanch, Long Island, that raised generations going to one, you know, medical center. The issue of helping and giving back is so much in our families, and so we just have to ensure that we keep focused on what's happening between families, parents, and kids. I do want to talk a little bit about foundation, though, because in addition to parents, you know, raised in public schools, because my parents very much, my dad was a teacher, my mom was the head of the PTA, and they kept me in public schools as long as they could in Hempstead, New York, predominantly African-American at that time, I'm not going to say what year, and then when the school started really going south, moved me to a private high school out in Long Island, New York, that was predominantly white. And I think that was really my first experience in terms of black faces in white places, because I was tracked. I was clearly tracked. My senior year, I was taking bookkeeping. I was taking advanced accounting. And, you know, I was being equipped to become a secretary. And secretaries are important. You know, I was not given any support in terms of college readiness or thinking about schools, and was really, you know, encouraged to stay local, and the bar was set so low. Somehow, some way, and because the man was working above, I picked up a brochure for Fisk University at a college fair, and it changed my life. And folks that know me know I'm a huge advocate for historical black colleges and universities, particularly for our young black men. Because there, Randall, you mentioned it, and all that we know about the importance of teaching people their history, showing young men and young women that we are strong, accomplished people, success runs in our race, which is another book that I like. You know, coming out of Fisk and Howard, it was a very different experience from where I was in high school. And then, and this is always an important piece to talk about, when I reflect on sort of where I am today and how I got here, because people chuckle at the fact that my first job out of Howard was working for Marion Barry in the Barry administration. And, you know, there's a story about Marion Barry that everybody loves to tell, but I will tell you, when I came out of college and I went to work for one of the first black mayors of a major urban city, it was the most amazing teaching and learning experience and a nurturing experience. And that's where most of my mentors are, both black and white, actually, from was that second the second administration of the Barry administration, where I worked for him for a number of years, and to this day can call on a number of folks that have just helped me. So the importance of putting our young people in places where they can see not only the product but understand the progress is really important, and that's just a little footnote on what I'm doing. So in terms of context, and we can jump into it, when we think about philanthropy, and I'm now at the Association of Black Foundation Executives, you know, there are over 60,000 foundations in this country, about 70,000 actually now. We are less than 3% of CEOs. We are less than 3% of trustees. We're probably about 15% of program staff. So I almost have enough fingers and toes to count the number of black foundation presidents that we have in the country. And our membership are really struggling and challenged with the issues of being the only one, the isolation. They clearly are the black faces in white places. Three things that I'll just say resonated for me, Randall, as I read the book. And this is interesting to be able to reflect. It's a little weird. But I also get the opportunity to talk to young students and young black male students a lot. My husband is an administrator at Bowie State University in Bowie, Maryland. And as much as I can, my time, it's really the way that I give, is my time, I spend talking to students. Matter of fact, there's something coming up next week. And there are three things in the book that I'm happy to say that I always mention. And so now I can really give them the book and say, I got it from somewhere, actually. So the first was, and is, always to reach a little beyond your comfort zone. There's actually, in one of the game-changing strategies, a story and some ideas about reaching beyond your comfort zone. And for some reason, and maybe it was that foundation, not only from my parents, but from the black colleges and for who I worked for, I always went for jobs that were a little over my head, just a little beyond my reach. And I'm not quite sure what that was about. I don't know if that was the Leo in me. I'm not sure what that was. But what it did actually was always make me grow and learn. What came with that often is that beyond this job, actually every position I've had before, I've either been A, the youngest person on staff at my level of seniority, or B, the only person of color. Prior to working in philanthropy, as I say, I have a public service background. The U.S. Department of Agriculture is about as white as you can get. And here was a, I won't say a C student, a student that was getting C's, actually going for a analyst position within the Food Nutrition Service that literally was putting together, you know, formulas for pricing school lunches and school breakfasts. That's just an example. It's pretty funny when I think about it now, of the reach that I was making in terms of just getting out of my comfort zone. So I tell folks all the time, young folks, when I'm talking to them, to do that. What that did, though, was bring all the angst of what happens when you're different. Again, I was always the youngest, or I was always the person of color until I got to this position. So that brings up the second sort of game-changing strategy that resonated with me that had a lot to do with strength in numbers and had a lot to do with connecting to mentors. This concept of strength in numbers, when I did move to philanthropy, I actually was a little, I was very lucky, matter of fact, because I went to the Annie Casey Foundation, as has been said, and I thought that's what philanthropy looked like. It was a very diverse foundation at that time. There were a lot of black folks there. And it's interesting, though. There were a lot of African Americans there. We all did happen to be on the same floor, now that I think about it. And you know what? We used to call our hallway Little Soweto, actually, because, and we were all in the community change unit. And, you know, when the community change, it's like the black part of the cafeteria, you know. So, because you could walk by the conference room and say, oh, that's a finance meeting, because there were no black people in there. But if there were a bunch of black folks in there, oh, that's the community change unit. But nonetheless, I think everything that we did at that foundation really was about numbers. And everything that I've been able to do really has come with the partnerships and the support that I've gotten in terms of numbers, and numbers nationally. So this concept of exposure, and I think this is really key to the Campaign for Black Male Achievement, the concept that we are connecting people in Mississippi to folks that are in Baltimore. You know, I just came from Portland, Oregon not too long ago, where we're 11% of the population, talking to blacks in philanthropy there. They're probably all three black folks in philanthropy in Portland, Oregon. But talking to them about how what they're doing in Portland matters to what's happening in Chicago, matters to what's happening in Anacostia, D.C., is critically important. So this concept of strength in numbers and giving folks broad exposure, it's literally, I think, what I would say positioned myself to do at Casey was the minute I could get exposure nationally, I did. And I used Casey as a platform to do that. When we work in these big organizations, we can tend to get tunnel vision and think that the world are the walls in which we work, just like some of our kids think that the world are the communities in which they live. This issue of broad exposure is really, really important. And then the last theme that I'll mention, so we can jump into a conversation before the gentleman actually talks, that's right, in terms of a game-changing strategy that resonated with me, was this idea about, you were talking, Randall, at the end about acting entrepreneurially. You all have to read the book, because there is also a strategy around thinking and acting intrapreneurially. And it's something that resonated with me. You know, when I got to the foundation, it was very, very clear. As I moved into, and prior to going to Casey, I would say I was a consultant with several national foundations. It was clear to me that the rules didn't apply to everybody, right? People had funny name, funny titles that you could tell they were sort of created and organized for folks. You know, people weren't necessarily working on the things that they were hired for. And I had to chuckle at this and myself because I guess I've broken a lot of rules. Because once you understand that rules don't apply to everybody, it's actually hard to stay within them. So this concept of using what you can to organize the work that gives you passion, that you have passion about, is critically important. And I think we've got to continue to tell our young folks about thinking entrepreneurially. Don't stay in the box. So, what do we think?
Mrs. Hello.
Oh, there we go. This is not a great panel. Can we get another round of applause for the panel? We got a lot of successful people up here. All right, so I don't have a really long success story besides graduating. We could get into that. But yeah, that's right. I got a degree. All right, so, but I can really resonate to this young lady on my left about, you know, not being ready for school, not being educated, but not knowing about the process of going into school. I actually went to Bronx Community College to get enrolled there, and I was there from 7:30 in the morning to 8 o'clock at night trying to figure out how to register for classes because I didn't know that you had to have financial aid before you did that. So even though I didn't register right after I got out of high school, I said, you know, I'm going to work. Worked at McDonald's for 4 months, and I said, okay, yeah, this is a real good reason why I want to go to school. ended up going to Borough Manhattan Community College. It took me a while to get out of there, about 4 years, even though it's a two-year school, but I wouldn't let that stop me. You know, I was going to work full-time, going to school full-time, got really sick, and the doctor said it's one or the other, and I said, I know it's the education. So I went there, and I'm thinking, like you were saying, we're not exposed to broad exposure, things of that nature, don't know what's going on until I hit up Dr. Burl Duncan Wilson, and she is going to hate me because I haven't seen her in a couple of years. She told me to apply for the Vassar transfer program, and I did that for about 6 weeks, where we went upstate to this suburban school. It was like way out in Poughkeepsie, and we learned about various different things that really opened my eyes, being a young African-American male from the Bronx, going to public high school, where there's so many things that other people will learn way before I will learn them. You know, a lot of things I learned in college, some of my other colleagues that were non-African-American, they learned that in the eighth grade. So coming out of Vassar, went into Hunter College, you know, I knocked it out for a couple of years. And talking about broad exposure, I actually ended up going to India for a month, studying the culture, the religion, wearing a dhoti, which is a nicer way of saying man skirt in India, doing the dances, studying Kathakali. You know, looking at the different arts and cultures of India as well. But the funny thing about getting to the broad exposure, I had to jump to strategy 10, which is giving back generously. At Hunter, I make it a point to help out the other students with whatever. You need questions for a course, I can answer them. I study the admissions guide. I really had a lot of free time on my hands before I went to Hunter, so I was reading that admissions guide back and forth. A young lady came up to me and she said, well, I heard that there's a scholarship program. I don't know if I should get into it. And I said, scholarship program, let me look into it. I went to the English department. I got it for her. I said, you should apply for it. She said, I don't think I could do it. But like, trust me, I've seen the way you write. You can do it. So she applied for it and got the scholarship. And I said, you see, girl, what'd I tell you? And then the same thing happened to me for India. I said, you know, I don't think I'll be able to go to India because I don't have the money for it. And someone, it was my aunt, she said, no, because of all the things you've been doing at your school, somehow God's going to bless you. And then I got a financial aid check that was $3,944.68. I remember because I played it as a lotto number the next day. And it didn't really work out. Someone from Connecticut won that. You know how it goes. But, giving back generously does help in a form. It may not be in a material form where you can see it playing out. It just might come at you. So whatever you do, give back generously and just talk to somebody for 5 minutes. Someone is homeless, talk to them for 5 minutes, give them a quarter. If you see somebody that needs help with crayons, just, you know, help them out with their crayons. Just give back generously. It doesn't, you know, take that much time out of your day. Another thing I want to talk about is I wish this book was in some of my classes, man. I'm being honest with you, not sucking up to you or anything like that. Because, no, I got to be real. I got to be real with the brother, because I was reading this book. I'm like, why did this come out before I graduated? I could have made some moves. I could have been selling, you know, maybe some cotton candy for $5 at Hunter. You know, being an entrepreneur. But what truly resonated with me was thinking entrepreneurially. Entrepreneurially. Because so many things that were said that have been in my head as a young man, that it was like the book was like, Mike, you better get on your stuff. If you want to make it as an actor, if you want to do what you want to do, here are the steps right here. There's one about sparse contacts into contexts that you could use and borrow context, which I thought was beautiful. Because I always wanted, you know, when you're in school, you make a friend for a semester and that's it. When you're in school, you get all these contacts, you put them in your cell phone, Twitter, whatever, you never hear from them again. But when you begin to come out of that and know more focus on what you want to do, you will meet certain people that will help you ascertain your agenda or your goal, and you will help that person also ascertain their agenda and their goal, which also goes back into strategy 10, giving back generously. Then there's a borrow context when you have a mentor, which Sean Dove's organization works very well with. You were speaking on that, and I have a mentor who I have to call. He's going to kick my butt, Kevin Magruder, who also helped me out. My mentor helped me out, and I had borrow contacts from him to figure out what I wanted to do, whether I wanted to be a lawyer, go into teaching, or if I wanted to do acting. And I actually ended up calling a gentleman for acting, and he gave me a lot of wonderful tips. He told me to start up a blog, make sure I network with people that are going where I'm at, make sure you talk to people that will help you ascertain your goal, because I learned the hard way about making a goal and getting it thrown back at me, because I was trying to throw, you know, like a little rhyming hip-hop freestyle tournament, nothing crazy. Nothing like, you know, nothing derogatory or defaming, nothing like that. It was purely about the art. And I was working with the gentleman, and I was working for months and months. I said, all right, you just find out two things for me. It's about a room that we need. And I said, all right, bet. And I could just go and, you know, just be ambitious and get everybody I want. And he took 2 months to get back to me and just emailed me and said, you know what, man, I just think we should just make it a showcase. And I'm like, my idea was to make it a tournament. You're not squaring me what's going on. Found out that the man was basically doing it for his resume. I mean, he was doing six different things and was about to graduate. I'd rather him been honest with me and said, look, I won't be able to do it with you because I'm doing six different things at once. Had I known that, I would have networked with somebody else, and that, you know, my idea, my vision would have came to fruition. So I'm not going to talk too long. I want to give it, because this is a star right here. This is a man that, you know, brought this book out. And I really love this book. You want to sign it for me? You know,
have it to, man.
I really appreciate it. All right, let's begin discussing. Yeah,
thank you, everybody. That was excellent. Randall, I'm going to ask you if you have any comments or response to what the panelists said, if you'd like to share them first.
I want to get into the conversation with the audience.
Okay, great.
I'll defer my comments.
All right. So as Sean said, I'm going to get my Oprah Winfrey on. So, okay, great.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hi, good evening. My name is Terrence Gilchrist. I'm living in Newark, New Jersey. Thank you all for being so very open and honest. I'd like to kind of speak about the title of the book. It reminds me of Frantz Fanon's Black Skin, White Mass. And the question that I have, given what we are seeing with the upheaval in North Africa and the Middle East, and given the game strategy set that's laid out in this text, there's going to be a point in time in which accommodation is no longer going to be tenable in these first world advanced industrialized countries, and those who have hegemonic power are not going to be able to hold on to that power given what's happening within the countries. When that point in time comes and accommodation is no longer tenable, what do you then recommend? So if I can make this a little bit more concrete, for those of us who have spent our time and our diligence being excellent, being passionate, you know, addressing whatever issues that we have, we encounter periods when we're working with colleagues where our ideas, our insights are kind of going beyond what they have. And if I could then take that into something larger, we as a people have insights that are very transformative to the way that our countries are arranged. I'd like to know, what do you have to recommend when we come to a point in time where what we, the system that's in place is no longer operational for many people in the world? Thank you.
Well, you know, it's interesting, going back to the book where you talk about different streams in terms of being entrepreneurial, you know, that it's not just about, you know, leaving your job and becoming an entrepreneur, but, you know, thinking about, you know, what it means to be creative, resourceful, and the like. When that day comes, I think it's critical for us to know how to operate things that we are currently kind of employees of, so that when that opportunity comes, whether it be in terms of, you know, an opportunity to take the reins ourselves or to be about enterprise building, as is discussed in the book, that we're prepared to do so. I think, though, that from my perspective, humbly, I think what you're more likely to see is some of the transitions that have occurred in places like South Africa, where there have been these earth-shedding events, but you need to make sure you have the resources, the skills, to take the operational controls of the machinery. So rather than wait for the day where, you know, basically people of color are in, you know, in mass control of everything in the world, we can only hope, I think we just need to be ready and willing to be able not only to take the operational controls, but to also leverage the resources and the relationships. I mean, as Randall and his co-author say in the book, you know, mentoring and leveraging contacts is not just about people that look like you mentoring you. It's across a number of different age groups, ethnic backgrounds, and even, you know, gender. A lot of my mentors in my career have been, you know, white men and white women. And if I were looking for a brother to be my mentor, I'd still be looking based on the career path that I've chosen. So I think we need to be open about that. But I think you're right. I think we should always, and one of the guiding principles I've tried to incorporate in my professional life is, you know, when you're learning, you have to always remind yourself, well, this is what the person is telling me as to how they would do it. I need to figure out how, when I'm in control, how I would do it, but always have that guidepost as to what the right thing to do is. So again, hopefully that's responsive to your question, but, you know, that's how I would answer it.
That's good.
Hi, my name is Bruce Hubbard. I'm an attorney here in New York and a Rutgers graduate like Randall. I'd like to shout out for Rutgers.
It's just you and me, man.
One thing that I'm very concerned about, and I work with 100 Black Men and a lot of other organizations that are involved with mentoring and providing access to programs, and we run college fairs and golf programs and chess programs, et cetera. And it's very frustrating, and I live in Stamford, Connecticut. Most of the programs I'm involved with are in Connecticut. And I'm involved with some, like with CSS in New York, because I work in New York. But we're frustrated when we have large funded programs. Like, we run a college fair every year. We bring in 50, 60 colleges. 25 will be HBCUs. And then it'll be majority school. In Stamford, Connecticut, we'll get 38 kids that will show up when we have a capacity for much larger numbers. We had a program for Black History Month this Saturday. We had Mayor Dinkins speak. We had Howard debate Rutgers. We had a whole day-long program, breakfast, lunch, dinner. And then we got 60 kids. What is happening in our communities when people complain that people don't do things, and then organizations and people do things, and people don't show up?
I can take a stab at that. Having worked at organizations like National Urban League and working at an organization like the Apollo Theater, where the National Urban League experienced some of the same things that you're talking about and the Apollo didn't. And just think about using entertainment as a way to attract people. So I think, you know, you're talking about reaching young people. You have to come to them where they are. And many times we're not the audience and we don't understand how to reach them. And many times the organizations that have leadership at the top don't understand how to market to young people. So I would look at your marketing strategies. You know, I've worked with organizations. When I was at the Apollo Theater, you know, I wanted to start a health program because the health organizations were running these wonderful health fairs. They couldn't get people together. So we said, let us bring the marketing skills, and we would use entertainment, and we fill the house with people. And then we targeted it, you know, the entertainers we brought were different for different segments. So for the seniors, I had Ozzy and Ruby, and for, you know, the younger people, I had hip-hop artists. So, you know, you have to utilize the techniques and the, you know, the methods that attract a segment. And I think a lot of times our organizations aren't good at that. So typically nonprofits skip the whole marketing thing and think just because they're doing something great, people are going to show up. So you still got to reach people.
I want to just push back on that a little bit, because we have marketing people that are involved who are in marketing as their professional job, and we market through the schools, through the churches, through media, through the newspapers. So, I mean, that as a concept is not something that people are ignoring. And, for instance, one of our debate topics was hip-hop versus, you know, Barack Obama, which way do you go? I mean, we thought of that. One of the things that most of the panelists said that I think is important that we're neglecting now is, even in past generations when we were poor, we had a middle class concept about where we were going. Like, we didn't have any money, but I noticed a number of people on the panel who talked about what their parents did to them and what they could not do and where they were going. And we've lost that because we can't get, and in our programs we try to bring parents and invite them, they won't come. And we're not getting any, like, you know, like, a lot of us went to things, and you said that because our parents told us we were going.
You know,
I mean, we got an issue here.
I was just going to, what came to my mind is something that you said, you got to use the media. Whatever is the most popular radio station in Connecticut, talk to them. Talk to them and ask them who was the most popular artist around whatever age range you want to get. For your college or university, have them try to get that artist at your event. That is how you will get these kids to come through, because they're going to use Twitter, Facebook, MySpace, a whole bunch of things that kids pay attention to. Because a lot of kids, you talking about the newspapers, man. Kids, a lot of people ain't reading newspapers. They are on the internet 16 hours and then dedicate 2 hours of time to their homework. Find the most popular radio station you got in Connecticut, talk to them, ask them what is the most popular artist, and you will get a plethora of people at your event.
You know, I just want to add, I've been flipping this so long, I don't know if it's on or off now. Okay, I'm sorry. But there is a real deep issue, and I just mm-hmm. wanted to raise, I think we're always trying to figure out how do we get more folks to show up. Part of the organizing sort of background in me says, let's be happy we got that 38 and not see that as a failure, but we know we have the capacity to do more. I don't know how many of you have read Eugene Robinson's new book called Disintegration, The Splintering of Black America, but I think it's really important to talk about the splintering of Black America. We just did some work with a number of foundations in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and it was, the Poise Foundation, which is a black foundation there, attempting to put together an agenda for the black community in Pittsburgh. And it was an interesting thing. We talked to black families about what they needed. We talked to black nonprofits about what they were offering. And then we talked to foundations about what they were funding. And it was a quagmire of you know, ideas and issues. And what the to cut to the chase, while black-serving nonprofits were doing well-intentioned work to get to black families in neighborhoods in Pittsburgh, the fact of the matter is they weren't actually providing what families really said they needed. And it has something to do with the fact that, yes, we always used to be poor, but there is extreme poverty now in many of our communities. Extreme poverty. And black families talked about the need to have respite, to spend time with their kids, just to talk to their kids every day, you know, to have quality family interactions, you know, the idea of potentially going on a vacation that many of us take for granted. And there were a set of services that well-intentioned nonprofits are providing in Pittsburgh, but they're more about social services. They were more about the important things of getting kids into college and the like, and it, in this situation, just wasn't what Black families were saying they needed because of the extreme poverty that's happening. So I say all that to say, and I lift up Eugene Robinson's book, is that I think we always have to be sort of focusing in on where are our families now relative to where our nonprofits are that are really offering good services. And then the foundation community was a whole other issue. They said they couldn't find any nonprofits to fund in the Black community, and then you have that piece as well. So it's just this bifurcation within race has a lot to do with class. You know, a lot came out about who was running nonprofits and how different they were, Black folks, thank you, how different they were from the Black families they were trying to serve. There's a lot there, so, yeah.
And I want to just add briefly so we can get back to the dialogue, piggybacking off what Susan said, when we did work at my firm in a low-income community, we do a lot of work in low-income communities, and you probably know that. What we realized when we were doing some outreach to families in the neighborhood is that we weren't providing enough of the scaffolding for them to be able to get their kids there in the first place. That there was a segment of the community that would have loved to be there, but they didn't have the child care, they didn't have the transportation, they didn't have the resources, et cetera. And so we stood here thinking that this is a great program. If we build it, they will come. And it's not that they didn't want to come, it's that they couldn't come. Mm. So what's the takeaway? I think it requires a different set of partnerships and a different set of conversations to say what is the real circumstances of the families we're endeavoring to serve and how can we literally meet them where they are. Mm-hmm. And if you need child care to get the child there, for the baby, to get the 13-year-old there, or if you don't have the car to get from your house to the gymnasium, we're going to figure out how we get you that too. And that opens up the possibilities of who you can now work with to make sure that you can get the radio station to get the folks there in the first place. Mm-hmm.
Okay, we have about 5 minutes, so what I'm going to do is take a couple more questions, and then I'm going to, after I get those questions, I'm going to ask you all to respond, okay? So we'll get about 3 more questions, and then the panel could have an opportunity to respond before we do a closing remarks.
Hi, my name is Adolf DeBose, first year MIT Sloan, shout out to Randall.
MIT.
My question, real briefly, in stages 3, 4, and 5, you're pursuing excellence, you're trying to build the right relationships, you're pursuing the right mentors, and trying to gain wisdom. Well, while you're doing that, you're running the race, you know, your time is precious, you have family. When do you give back? When is there time to give back? And at what point do you start giving back if you're still running the race?
Greetings, panelists. Greetings, Village. My name is Dallas Lee Bell. I have, in 2012, I will have 20 years service in the National Urban League, and I'm a native of the north side of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Came out of the same neighborhood as Lamon Rucker. I also am an individual with a very unusual family configuration. I have 6 generations alive and well in my mother's side, 6 generations alive and well in my father's side. I sit and count them every month. And I just wanted to know, what do we do as Pittsburghers, as New Yorkers, as Newark inhabitants, as Philadelphia people, as Washingtonians, what do we do as people of African descent to break out of the silos?
Okay, we're going to take 2 more, and then.
Hi, my name is Genevieve Jones, and I'm out of New Jersey, and Randall helped mentor my son, and I appreciate that. So I want to ask, though, the panel, in this whole mentoring and entrepreneurship, what happens to second-generation middle-class kids, too? There's so many programs for kids who don't have anything, for kids who don't have anything. But there is also a lot of difficulty for the today's kids, the privileged kids who don't know what decisions to make, where to go. And guess what? A lot of today's middle class kids run into the pulling of gangs. What do you do?
My name is Frederick Mann, and I have a quick question. I'm interested. I'm really fascinated with this discussion and in a lot of discussion that's been coming out around mindsets and just from various psychologists and writers about how to negotiate in these various spaces. One of my questions is, I went to Columbia, got a degree in counseling and psychology, and so I have a connection with some of these ideas, but my biggest question is, how can we translate these such powerful ideas, in addition from texts and discussions in these great groups and foundations, but how do we disseminate this information in various ways where you don't have to have a doctorate in psychology, or what do you see as a vision in terms of just translating your own knowledge around biographies and books and insights that you've gained that gave you the edge to say, oh, this is one way to look at the world, but this is how people of color have figured out another way. This is a new strategy, or this is our edge, because we do bring an edge to an experience. And so my question is, how do we translate these great thoughts and information that can disseminate beyond people who are, in many ways, privileged in certain circles to get access to these stories?
Okay, response?
Is it round robin?
Yeah, we'll start with you.
Okay.
Choose one.
So, it's a lot there. See if I can be very efficient with my thoughts. I'll be extremely efficient. At what point do you give back? You can give back right now. You need not delay when or how. It's just a question of your commitment and willingness to give back. High school students can give back to junior high school students, and for that matter, they can give to their parents too. So I don't think it's a question of if, but how and how much. How do we break out of the silos? I think we've got to create more spaces where we're promoting dialogue across those silos. And I really think that the greatest opportunity today is across ethnicity, that we have not created enough spaces to bring blacks and Latinos and Asian Americans and the like. And the journalists of color have given us one of the best examples. They have an organization called Unity, which is an organization of organizations that includes the National Association of Black Journalists, the Hispanic Journalists, the Asian American Journalists. And every 4 years, each organization abandons its national conference and does one conference together. And they get the President of the United States to come speak at that conference. Why? Because they came together. If they were to try to get that individually, it would never happen. And so that's just one example of how we break out of the silos, is examples like Unity. Second generation middle class kids, I'm gonna punt on that one because I can talk to you offline, Genevieve. We go to the same church. Translation and dissemination to others, you do what Sean Dove is doing. I mean, he's working with groups that are on the ground, that are doing the kind of marketing that we discussed and getting into the grassroots and into the communities, into the hard places where it's hard to get to, young men that are disenfranchised or are not part of the worlds that we live and walk in, and they're the people like Sean are the ones providing the resources to groups to get that word out. I'm done.
Very well done. Okay. Other comments?
You know, I'll just hit on a few. That was pretty amazing. A few I think that Randall did hit on, and then I'll take one that he didn't. When do you give back in terms of when you're still running the race? The gentleman said, you know, I really feel that in order to keep running, you got to give back. There's something about taking the time to give, and whether that's time, talent, or treasure. I was saying that mine is really about time. It is a way to heal. And I think that we have to be clear that the work that we're doing, we need to take the time to heal. So I don't separate sort of the stages in this work, that if you're running the race,
giving back is part of that, because it will help you. It will help sustain you. When you look in a kid's eyes and you tell them what you know, that helps you keep going. The piece around how do we break the silos, about the middle class children, I won't punt on that. One of the things that I think we've just got to get more savvy at is disaggregating. When we say that we're working for the improvement of black men and black males in this country, that we really intentionally dig deep and talk about who we're talking about. So that has everything to do with class, but it also has everything to do with ethnicity. When we say the campaign for black male achievement, we're not just talking about African-American males, we're talking about immigrants, foreign-born black men. And so what we find when we talk to foundations about our mission is to promote responsive philanthropy in black communities, the first thing we have to say is, now let's define black, right? And let's have a conversation about who we're talking about. So I think we just have to find more spaces to intentionally take the time to talk about how different black people are faring. And that will help us, I think, focus on the issues of not only ethnicity, because we are many people, but also issues of class. So, and I don't think we are well-intended, but we don't take the time to talk about the different subpopulations within our broader diaspora. So, and that's it for me.
I'll take a stab at two, not all four.
Okay.
So the first one I'd speak to is the one about giving back. As I said in my remarks, I mean, it gets tough. You know, when you're putting in a lot of hours and you have your home, your household responsibilities, you know, there's going to be limited amounts of free time you have. If you're active in a church, if you're active in terms of your, you know, when my daughters were growing up, I made sure that I, you know, participated in, you know, bring your dad to school day and talk about what he does. And again, at some point, you know, we went from a very, mixed neighborhood to being a predominantly white neighborhood. But it was even more important for me to show up at the school then so that the white kids could see that, you know, it's not just the stereotypes they see on television, about black men. So I think you gotta find what's comfortable to you, right? We all can't be, you know, community organizers or Malcolm X. We have to find that true voice that works for us. And to Dr. Pinkett's point, you can do that at any point. So it doesn't have to be grand. It can be a micro impact. So that's the first thing I would say. With regards to the middle class issue, and this is going to be not very popular, so forgive me in advance, folks, but I think I have the greatest indictment for the folks who have been successful. Where are we? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because quite honestly, you know, you know, as I look back now, as I get close to that 50-year mark, and I look back at my legacy as a group of people, I mean, you know, our prior generation made the path for us. What have we done for the folks coming behind us? So that's the first thing as a generational issue amongst folks that are similarly situated. The second thing is, I made a sacrifice in terms of not doing some of the things that I had a grander vision of when I was younger, and being the race guy at Wesleyan and being all about Mr. Nationalist. I put the time to raise my two daughters, making sure that they had every opportunity in front of them in terms of choices. Now, they can decide at the end of the race they didn't want to go to this school or that school, but no counselor was going to tell them they couldn't go to whatever school they, you know, they decided. And if I allowed that to happen, that was on me, no one else, but as me as a parent. So I think you're right. I think the challenge for us as in that group is that, you know, we have to find the right balance between affording our kids choice and giving them direction. And I think at points, because my kids have the same challenges now, what I want to be, I don't know what I want to do, but I think we have to try and give them a default as they go through this stage in life. And if they decide they want to do something like acting or something else, NGO work, let them prove to me, you know, that they're committed to that. But I think what we fail to do is to give them that default, and it may sound like we're being, I don't know, what you call lion parents as opposed to tiger parents, you know, we need to be about giving them some firmer direction, because I think we've, as a community, I think it's popular to give our kids too much choice, and that leaves them kind of rudderless.
I agree.
All right, we are really backed up against time, so I want you all to know that. Sorry.
I'll be quick. To the gentleman that asked, how do you give back when you're raising a family? Man, the book says that your purpose may be to be a parent. And you're giving back, spending time with your kids. You telling them about your process going to school, honestly, is giving back. Like I said, I didn't have that info. I had to learn everything myself. But you are being a conduit for your children to let them know how they should go about going to school, getting an education, letting them know what they have to do in life. Because there's a saying around among African priests that I met at like National Black Theater in Harlem that we stand on the shoulders of our ancestors. So you are right now, or someone here to tell your kids what to do. And when you're deceased, hopefully that'll be a long time from now, your kids will tell their kids about their grandfather that helped them out in school, and then it'll continue on like that. Second-class citizens is what you were talking about. I always go by the motto, you're talking about kids avoiding gangs, I go by the motto that if the oven is hot, don't touch it. And if you do touch it, don't ever touch it again. You know, you got to show them that lifestyle that seems nice in the media and Hollywood is negative. What I did was I called Brother Bruce Leff, 100 Blacks in Law Enforcement, because I was teaching kids and I wanted to let them know about the civil rights after the whole Sean Bell incident so that they would know how to avoid certain sticky situations. So you have to show them physically, not just talk to them about it. You have to get other groups involved to come through and maybe you have to bring some kids to a Scared Straight program. It just is what it is. And disseminating information, this gentleman over here, is difficult but not feasible. I think I don't even have kids. Parents of my generation, let's just say that, have to figure out how to be more tech savvy in terms of acquiring knowledge and information about letting kids know what they can do in order to broaden their horizons. Because a lot of kids do different things on Twitter or Facebook for social media, social networking. And the only time they're probably researching is for their reports or anything like that. They might not try to look up Howard University or Monroe College or any other university, things of that nature. That's us as parents. That's what some parents should do in order to help their kids out. There we go. Pass that on.
Just want to say a couple things. I think the whole idea of values has to do with a lot of what we're talking about. And just want to encourage anybody of the questions that you just asked about what do we do. Actually, you can start something, even if it's small. Because if you understand an issue, because a lot of this stuff, there's no case studies. There's no real information about what needs to be done. So if you know, then start something. Play with it. You know, my life's purpose, as I talked about being a stressed executive at some point and, you know, understanding that what I thought I was afraid of was being poor, I kind of made a decision that I never want to have more than $10,000 in the bank, that I want to give away everything other than the $10,000. And that sounds really weird. It's against American values, you know, to share everything you have right now, not to hoard it and to do it later on. So that's a different way of thinking. But I decided that came from me. That was my heart, what it was telling me to do. And I want to take the chance about whether I'm going to be poor in the end or not. So that's my thing. So everybody has something different. And for parents who have, wealthy parents who have kids, you're probably going to have to face the thing where some of your kids don't want to be wealthy. How do you deal with that? They don't want to do that. They want to do something else. So allow them to do that, just like some of us want to be wealthy. And I think that's where coming together with poor people, like I said, understanding they have something to offer. They taught me something about myself.
Okay. Thank you. At this point, we had a wonderful discussion, and I want to thank OSI for hosting and being a part of this and call Sean up to say closing remarks. And if you all will join me in giving the panelists and Dr. Pinkett a round of applause.
Well, I just want to just thank everyone for sharing their time, talent, and treasure. This was a really inspiring conversation. It just reminds me that we have got to stop waiting for iconic leaders to come into our communities and to transform things, because we are the iconic leaders that we've been waiting for, and so I'm really inspired. Nicole did a really great job, and so we let's give her a round of applause. I'm going to, and this is just, you know, the beginning of a conversation. I hope you are making connections here tonight, that you will leave here with a connection with someone that you did not know here before you came, and build a collaboration and help build our community. So the deal is, we kind of went a little bit over, so the after party is not in here, but on your way out, Randall will be selling and signing his book. And I strongly encourage you, you know, we purchase our copies. We're giving them out to young people, some young people in the Harlem Children's Zone, that they're going to get copies of the book. A few of them were here this evening and they had to leave. Purchase a copy, pass it on, and just want to thank you all very much. And Randall, keep doing what you're doing. All right.